Welcome to the Good Areas live channel and another podcast. This is The Wagon Wheel, the show in which we answer your questions about cricket. If you're on the YouTubes, the best way of doing that is via a super chat. And if you're not on the YouTubes, the best way of doing that is doing them beforehand on Patreon, which, you know, is awkward if you haven't already done that. But some of those people have, like Ali, who comes up with his question. On Patreon, you can find us on Patreon, do all those things. Anyway, which power play field or non-power play field you're surprised that no one has implemented thus far? I suppose everything's been implemented. We've seen the team not have a wicketkeeper before, right? So we've certainly seen teams try all sorts of things when it comes to fielding. But I think the thing that I find more surprising is, and I talked about this on the podcast with Bayram that we did on it yesterday or whenever it was, the day before. And you look at it and you say, is there a situation here where we eventually just get past the idea that you just have to put everyone out when the power play finishes? That's always been one for me of like, if you're on top as a bowling team, do you have to put everyone out straight away? And it's never quite followed for me that that's an automatic thing. And then the other one is, I just think when teams are trying to build pressure, you know, that we're talking about games that are, I don't know, maybe the other team's got like a 70% chance of winning or whatever it might be. You know, if you can get to a situation where you are getting close or, you know, the other team's in front, why not just bring extra fielders in? And it quite often happens right at the end. I don't know. I just think you can be a lot more creative with your fields than we've seen before. There seems to be something there that is not particularly working. All right. Why have I lost the comments? Here we go. Not the comments, question. Rob says, with their major reduction in test cricket, what are your thoughts on the future of international cricket in South Africa? It's not that much different than the future of international cricket everywhere. Like, it's in danger everywhere. I haven't quite looked into the full thing, and I'd have to talk to someone like Neil Manthorpe to get the full picture on it. But there seems to be other things going on at the moment. But yeah, it's what we've been saying the last couple of years. They've put all their eggs in the SA20 basket. They've decided to go in with the IPL ownership. That is probably the future of cricket. It might be one of the better plays that anyone's made. They don't make a lot from their international cricket. They don't lose a lot, but they don't make a lot. So I think we're getting closer and closer to international cricket being the secondary form of the game. Manon says, with everyone showing so much intent in the IPL, does it become a game of who can manufacture more wickets? It was funny, Manon, because Shane Bond came out today or yesterday, whenever it was, saying that bowlers are going for wickets too much. I kind of think you could go even more for wickets. So yeah, I do think, I don't know if you can stop current day players because they have so many more options than players in the 90s and 2000s of scoring boundaries. They train so many different shots. They can now flip over their shoulders. They can play reverse sweeps. They've got all this variability that they can play. And that was the big change in ODI cricket, wasn't it? Of how can we manufacture wickets? And then on top of that, probably manufacture dot balls is the other one. So we've seen Varun Chakravarty and Sunil Narine and probably Ashwin are probably, these are just the spinners, that there are some quicks who do this as well, are very, very good at just bowling four singles. So I think it's kind of the combination of the both still. But yeah, I definitely think you have to get teams out. It's getting harder and harder to dismiss players because with the impact sub, you're going a batter deeper anyway, right? William says, with your love of Jim Foat, Benny Howe and Ian Harvey, are you going to be cheering for the Mighty Gloucestershire this summer? No, I mean, I do like all those players. Who did Gloucestershire have last year? Did they go okay last year? I'm trying to remember what their squad was. I'm positive. I know I bet on one of their games and did quite well. It must have been in the Blast or whatever it was. But didn't they have an interesting Blast squad? I'm trying to remember who they were. No, I don't really have a county side, if we're being honest. When I first came over, I lived next to the Oval, so I kind of was vaguely interested in the Oval. And then I was like, but actually, I've always been interested in Yorkshire and Lancashire, so I'll pick one of them. So decided to go with Yorkshire. Then I got offered a job at the Oval very briefly. It did not last very long. I kind of went back and forth. And in the end, I really haven't ended up with a team. There are just individual teams in county cricket that sometimes I follow a bit more. A bit like the IPL. I don't really have a team in the IPL either. I would say there are very few franchise or domestic teams that I kind of support. I just kind of have a passing interest depending on the team. Ian says, are there any stats on how effective wicketkeepers or even slip fielders might be with regards to left and right-handed batters respectively? Obviously, the core skills will be the same, But are there players who are particularly better at one or the other? I would assume so, Ian. I don't have those stats. I think maybe Crickviz might be able to look that up. I was a first slip, and I always felt, when I was fielding at first slip against right-handers, I felt really, really comfortable. When I was fielding at first slip against left-handers, I just felt like I was always in the wrong position. Having said that, one of my best catches ever was, was at slip. Diving, first slip diving, because the wicketkeeper didn't move for one. But generally, I don't think I felt as comfortable for the left-handers. And at second slip, I didn't feel any difference. And with wicketkeeping again, I just felt like my left foot with wicketkeeping was the one that sort of got me into my movement. And when you're wicketkeeping to a right-hander, it's your right foot that kind of, for me anyway, I assume it's the same for all wicketkeepers, but I'm not an expert in wicketkeeping. Got it in. And so it felt like everything was backwards. So I'm assuming you're right. I don't know if that is, you know, something that we could search, but if we can, I think it's fascinating. MF Jim, and I talked to MF Jim today, he is an MF Doom fan, so we can all be comfortable with that. After watching some late 90s and early 2007 Pure Cup highlights, and then you mentioning we don't know who invented the hook shot, did Ryan Campbell invent the scoop, or did anyone do it regularly before? So Ryan Campbell's shot is not quite a scoop, MF Jim. It's kind of more like a reverse. It's not even a reverse, but it's kind of more like a paddle. I think if you go back, the Marillier Douglas Marillier, that's easier, which is what we used to call it before we started calling them scoops and ramps. I think if you look at that, his shot is probably a little bit more like what we see now, whereas the Ryan Campbell one was a little bit different again. And I would say Ryan Campbell's shot is a lot more like Tillichartney Dilshan's in that it showed batters that there was a possibility to hit in that direction, but I don't think batters necessarily copied that style. That's my memory of Ryan Campbell, whereas the Marillier one has become sort of the style. But if you look at scoops and ramps, quite often it's just getting in that position and then you get the ball away. So there are still people who play the Ryan Campbell shot, even if they're probably not trying to. But I think I've looked at the dates before, but I think Douglas Marillier went before Campbell anyway. I know I've written about it somewhere before, but I'm pretty sure that's right. Joe Bowden says, what are your thoughts on the England captaincy situation? What do you think about the idea of Ben Stokes captaining all three teams with others filling in when necessary? Also, do you think it would be a good idea for Phil Salt to be T20 captain and allow him to focus solely on that format, similar to what India have done with Scott? Not sure that England can be that picky and choosy with their top order players, Joe. So I'm not sure about the Phil Salt one. The problem I would have is, I actually think in the future that might be what we see, which is, let's say we've got Pat Cummins as a captain. There's another bowler I'm forgetting who also is going to be captain. Tim Southee, of course, recently. But there's someone else I was thinking about. We have to allow for the fact that captains are going to miss games, right? So that's fine. So you should have a leadership core and they should have a key way of doing things. The problem with Ben Stokes is he's such a fundamentalist and, you know, such a believer in his own core concepts, or however you want to put it, that I'm not sure anyone else can be a decent backup for him. Whereas I think there are other captains who are good captains. I'm not saying that they're not good, but they're just easier to replace and just follow the template. For instance, I think Jos Buttler has basically tried to follow Owen Morgan's template and hasn't been able to do it. So sometimes you can and sometimes you can't, right? The problem then becomes, how do you ramp back up at the right time of the year for big tournaments, World Cups and everything else? I would probably just look to move on from Ben Stokes in T20 cricket. And I can't imagine him playing one day cricket is going to help him or England with his injury concerns. Jane says, any idea why Stuart Surridge was never given an England cap? He left Surrey to 5 straight champion wins. Sure, Surridge was only a replacement level seamer. Almost got that out. But England seemed to have a thing for specialist captains both before him, Donald Carr, Nigel Harwood, and after it, Mike Brearley. Here are some stats to bolster his case. Between 1952 and 1956, Surrey won 86 out of 140 games, losing only 20. So what years are that? 1952 to 1956. Let's just look at the 1920s. 1950, sorry. My guess is in that period, what you have is a situation where England had a lot of other bowling talent and it was not particularly easy to fit him in. Also, let's not beat around the bush here. If he was a bowling captain who was, if he was a batting captain, with his kind of record, he probably would have come in. But for whatever reason, that's not quite how those things tended to go. it was much more rare to have a bowling captain at any stage, right? But certainly back then. They had Laker, Statham, Bedser, Truman, Locke, Bailey, Wardle, Tyson, Loader, Appleyard. They're pretty stacked with bowling in the 1950s. So is it that would have to be a part of it. And what's his name? Stuart Sturridge. If you don't know who Stuart Sturridge is, by the way, the SS bats, the English SS bats. And I wondered, the only other thing is, what was his, I'm trying to see, educated in Emmanuel School. Okay. So that means he was probably an amateur, I would assume, not a professional. So he comes from the right kind of family. Just assuming. I'm just trying to have a look through and have a look at his school. Yeah, his school is a public school, which is a private school, but don't get me started on England terms. So, yeah, I suppose they were pretty stacked as a team. Is there other times when perhaps they've gone with a captain like that because their team hasn't been as good? Is might be a part of it. And also, are you seen as a great captain, or are you seen as a captain of a great team? All these things play a part. Yeah, he was a fine player. That, you know, there have probably been worse players for him to play for England consistently, right? But it was a very good era, and it might have just been, you know, bad luck. But I don't know the full story. I did own an SS bat once, though, if that helps. PJ says, as a coach, Bob Woolmore was ahead of his time in terms of innovation. Unfortunately, he died in 2007, 1 year before the IPL began. How would he have taken to the modern era of T20 data, analytics, and technology? Fun fact, he was using a walkie-talkie earpiece to communicate with Hansi during the 99 World Cup. Yeah, before it was banned, as you say. It's fascinating to see where Bob Woolmore is. I think a lot of the, you know, Cape Town is this absolute hub of sports science. And I forget his name, Ross, I've forgotten his name, but there's a famous scientist who's done lots of sports scientists. There's obviously Dr. Cheryl Calder, who I talk about in my book, and I've written a piece on before. But there's heaps of these random sports science people, and not just sports science as well. I would say recreational science, if you know what I mean. So things like diet and fitness and all those sorts of things. And Bob Woolmore was kind of in the heart of it. And clearly he got hooked as well. And what a fascinating man he is. I've said this before, but the most important book in the history of cricket is probably, you know, it is probably C.L.R. James's book. But Bob Woolmore's book is perhaps the most important to the actual playing of the sport. It really is. I don't think you can underestimate just how much science is in his book. And it's 20 years before we're talking about some of this, right? It really is a fascinating, it's not like a readable book, but it is definitely something that you want to dip into in and out. It's probably a little bit outdated at the moment, but I still think it's a fantastic book. And I don't have that many books in my actual office space because the rest of them are with the rest of the cricket books in the house. But I always have that around, and I just randomly flick through it. So yeah, I think he would have taken to it, and he would have been a pioneer and all that. I probably would have pushed cricket forward. He pushed cricket forward in science, and he pushed cricket forward in acceptance of associate teams. This is his time, and I think he would have done it with women's cricket as well. All right, let's have a quick break, and we'll be back in a couple of seconds with more of the Wagon Wheel. Sometimes you just need to take the slips out and bowl defensively. And you also need to be careful with your computer's defense as well. If you need a VPN, go Nord. NordVPN.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. So put in some dot balls and turn them into maidens via NordVPN.com/Kimber. All right. We've already done PJ's question. Where are you here? KG says, I remember Chris Cranz once bowling a ball which came out of his hand like a beamer, but then viciously dipped and almost yorked the batter who was actually ducking the ball. Chris Reed, I think, is the ball you're talking about. Have you seen any other bowlers try this? Seems a very effective T20 variation. So what happened here is that early on, this happened a couple of times. And it doesn't happen anymore because players are used to this a little bit. It still can cause problems. I would say that Harshal Patel, Dwayne Bravo, and maybe Malinga are the three that I've heard batters complain about the most. And that's because those three put so many rotations on the ball. And also in Lasith Malinga's case, the kind of rotations he puts on the ball. But what you're really talking about is a slower ball, KG, with so many revolutions on it that it goes up and then comes down. So back of the hand slower balls are another one. It's more common in back of the hand slower balls. And you'll see a player back away a little bit and then pick it up. The difference now is that those kinds of slow balls with incredible amount of revolutions were fairly new at that time. So outside of the back of the hand slow ball, which you saw a couple of these sorts of situations in the 90s where someone would take a step back and then realize and then come back. It's very rare for them to make the decision that I think it was Chris Reed made, where you just think it's coming at your head. But I remember talking to Mark Chapman just after he faced Dwayne Bravo, and he was talking to me and Brad Hodge, and Hodge said, "What do you think of the slow ball?" And Chappie was like, "My God, I felt like it was coming at my face, and then suddenly it was at my toes." So that's what you're talking about. So the answer to your question is people bowl them all the time. It's just the batters are much more used to them now. Sandeep says, "You always speak highly of the NBA league structure and analytical bent. What are three top things that you would bring into the IPL if they ask you?" I'm not sure 100%. I think I speak highly of the NBA. I'm not sure I speak that highly of the structure. There's some major issues with their structure. Their season is probably, 20 games too long. They certainly have a lot of analytics. I've got a book, and I don't know where it is now, but I met the guy at Sloan who wrote it. He's the guy that does True Hoop, the True Hoop blog, about injury prevention. The last couple of years with the IPL teams and Cricket Australia, and I think the ECB, have really started to look into injury prevention. But I've been reading baseballers and basketball, and analytic stuff about baseball and basketballers for ages to just realize how much further advanced they are than we are in cricket. I just want players to play, right? So injury prevention and understanding of all those things is really, really important to me. So that's probably the main one I would want to bring in. If it was the IPL you're talking about, I've said this ages, I would get rid of the auction. I would have two drafts and a free agency, and you would get 50 times the amount of media coverage that you're currently getting. And I think it's a much better system. It's fairer for the players, and it's better for the teams on their way up who are struggling, who aren't the really good side. So I really like that. What's the other thing I would bring in? Mascots. Can a mascot bowl? What? I just don't understand why in cricket our mascots don't do enough bowling on the center wicket. What else do I like? I think if you're talking about the NBA in general, and I've just done a short video on this, will probably be going up while I'm talking here. There's not enough games in T20 leagues. And this isn't an IPL thing. This is right across the board. We're very rarely finding out who the best team is each season. And the reason for that is that, especially when it comes to playoffs, we're in a situation where we have you might be lucky enough to be in a league like the IPL where you get a second chance. You really, the finals, especially the final, I would argue all the finals, but let's just say the final should be a best of three. Right? Kerry Packer knew that. It's weird that we've kind of regressed in cricket. And T20 cricket, I think you need it even more. It's great for ratings. And if it's only two games, it's only two games. You don't have to play the third game. This isn't the Davis Cup, right? We can just stop. But it gives you an extra two games potentially on the end of your season. And they're the games everyone wants to watch because they're the most important games. I think that's just... T20 cricket is so random. The dew, the toss, a drop catch, a 15-minute window where someone just is hitting sixes. I just think it's a much more random sport to have a tiny season, which I already disagree with, and then not more games for the playoffs. Nadika says, "What exactly was a lob bowler in the underarm era?" Funnily enough, that goes back to whose question was that a minute ago? KG's question. The idea of a lob bowler was to get the ball up as high as possible, up above your eye line, and then drop it right down. I think the idea was to drop it on the stumps, but drop it at your feet. Drop it right in front of you. So it's kind of like an underarm version of a beamer. I would assume too that spin was involved, and that there was, I would assume you'd have to do wrist spin. So, if you could land it and then you could spin it, there's no pace on the ball. But it basically meant keeping the ball above your eye line as long as possible is the main way. And there's, the most, I wouldn't say he's the most famous one, but he's the last famous one, is a guy called The Lobster. If you Google The Lobster cricket, I should know his name. I've talked about him so much before. I remember when we were doing Test Match Sofa way back in the day, someone had sent them a picture of this guy and we didn't even know who he was. And we went into it and we were absolutely astounded to find out about it. Rudra says, "How do you rate Bhuvnesh Kumar's test batting? Average of 22 from 29 innings, strike rate of 45, high score of 63, not out. Could there have been a chance of becoming a low-end all-rounder?" And would he have been the perfect number eight when they kept picking Shardul Thakur? I think he's a number eight. I don't think he's an all-rounder. But there's, I thought he was a defense. Pat Cummins maybe is a good example of the kind of batter that I remember Bhuvie being. He had a very repeatable defensive technique. He could play shots. Probably Pat Cummins before Pat Cummins started whacking them as well. The sort of younger Pat Cummins. But that's how I remember him. Yeah, like as a very dependable, you know, and fine number eight. I think if you can average over 18 to, I know it's only 29 innings in this case, but what was his first class stats? Might tell us a little bit more. But I thought he had a very repeatable technique. No way he could have ever batted at seven consistently. I mean, maybe as a one-off. But in first class cricket, he averaged 26.29. Yeah, so yeah, probably a weak number eight, but who was handy. You almost want Stark and Cummins together in that sort of situation. So I don't know, Warne and Rifle. I'm trying to think of some other versions of that that you would have that you could put together. You know, no, Vittori's too good because he's really a number seven, isn't he? But yeah, I think that's what you're kind of looking at, isn't it? Maybe Swan and Broad would have been another one off the top of my head, where you don't have a really strong number eight, but you have a number eight and a number nine who can both give you runs. And that's very important. Ben says, should the IPL up the international player limit per game? It's not about Indian youngster development anymore. Surely more better players on the field means better cricket and therefore viewing. I don't understand why they need the Indian rule anymore. There's so many good Indian players around. I would get rid of the overseas limit altogether. If one team wants to go out with no overseas players and the other one wants to go out with nine, okay. From a marketing point of view, from a brand point of view, I think it brings about many different kinds of questions. But yeah, I would definitely do that. Sandeep says, there's an argument on one side for fully floating 3-7 batting lineup in T20 purely based on an optimum entry points and target left versus traditional order. Where do you stand on the spectrum? I don't think I don't agree with strict batting orders in any format of cricket, Sandeep. The conversation I have had with Test legends about this is always the same. If the score is 11-1, I want Jonathan Trott to come out. If the score is 200-1, I want KP to come out. That's the KP is in the side to maximize that role, to tire out the bowlers completely, to demoralize them, so that from then on in you can just knock the ball around against tired bowlers, right? Like, just that's all you need to do. Jonathan Trott is in the game for when it's tough and the ball's doing something, to come in and nullify it so that later on KP and Ian Bell and Matthew Pryor can come in and capitalize. So there's no format of the game where I don't think batting orders shouldn't be flexible. I think we've always got this wrong in cricket, and there's nothing that convinced me that we haven't. And the problem is now it's very hard to change people's minds because batters now believe they are number four and number three. It's actually, you're a number three in certain situations and you're a number six in other situations is a very normal way of doing it. And the future of batting, I would think, is that flexibility. Bloody says, in the past, baseball used to have some degree of popularity in Australia, e.g. Ian Chappell played baseball for South Australia. How has baseball influenced Australian cricket? Did it help batters adapt to white ball cricket as an American sport? Did it influence Australian sporting culture to reject amateurism and embrace professionalism? No, it had no real effect on any of that sort of stuff. In the old days, baseball was played in Australia in the winter and cricket was played in the summer. So if you were good at baseball, you just kind of, sorry, if you're good at cricket and that and you like baseball, you just kind of played both, right? So there was certainly an element. I know the Chappells talk about this. Alan Border talks about this. And I had friends who played baseball and cricket. You know, there wasn't a baseball team that close to me. The closest one was, you know, like a 40-minute drive or half an hour drive from my parents when I was younger. And so I would probably, all things considered, probably would have been a better baseballer than a cricketer, I think. And when we played at school, you know, no one could ever hit my pitches and I could whack them. Like, it's literally, I had a very big throwing arm and I whacked things, right? That was my two things. So I think I probably would have been better off with, and I was a spinner, so I could have done stuff with the ball. But I only played about 8 games and there just wasn't a team around. And occasionally a PE teacher would suggest I find one and we couldn't find one and all that sort of stuff. But I had friends who did it. Mostly the fielding was the thing that they talked about more than anything else. It was only later that baseball had an impact on Australian cricket was through, I forgot his name, but the Australian catcher who played for the Milwaukee Brewers, who I think, started suggesting that baseball fielding was taught better and at a more advanced level than cricket. And also he got Glenn McGrath to bowl with the split finger slower ball as well. Neil says, I remember you saying a few years ago that you had worked on another Three Cents feature. Do you still hope to publish that, or has the moment passed? P.S. Love the 2019 article. I haven't been to India in a few years, and I haven't talked to Three Cents in a while. I have a meeting, actually, with some publishers and some documentary producers and things on one idea that would involve Three Cents. I think the thing that you're talking about, Neil, I could be wrong, I think the project you're talking about was when he was trying to qualify to play for Scotland. We thought there was an idea. I think me and Sam Collins, who did Death of a Gentleman and has done all the famous football documentaries over the last couple of years. I think we thought about, if he goes to Scotland and he's Three Cents, that's a documentary, right? Like me and Robbie are talking about Three Cents the other day, right? Like he's a character. And I've never really done anything with him outside of that one piece, but I've occasionally chatted to him. There is one more project that I still would like him to be involved with. But as much as anything, I just want to sit him in front of a camera one day, proper professional setup, and just say to him, I want you to talk to me for 3 or 4 hours. Now, what I know about Three Cents is there's no way I'm keeping that camera on him. So maybe we just have to put a microphone on him and literally follow him around the house, because that's kind of how he works, or around the gym, or around everywhere. But I wish was it 2019 that article came out? I thought it was earlier than that. But I wish I had a camera crew then, because that was one of the most extraordinary days of my life. The first main day with him anyway, was certainly just one of the weirdest ones ever. And so there's a lot of interesting stories there. But yeah, there is one other project that he might be involved in, but I haven't talked to him about it and I haven't got anyone to give me money for it yet. So still a little bit further away than I'd like it to be. All right, let's have a quick ad, and then on the way back, there'll be more of me talking to you.
From Virat Kohli's MCG6 against Pakistan to Bumrah's stump-destroying Yorker to Ollie Pope, incredible things happen on the cricket ground. We also get iconic lines off it, like Siraj saying, I only believe in Jesse Bhai. There are so many incredible moments that cricket fans just never forget. And now you can wear them on your chest. Free Hit Gear has launched a line of amazing t-shirts and hoodie designs. Passionate fans in India can order through their website, freehitgear.com, while fans abroad can use Free Hit Gear on the Etsy store to have items delivered to them. Order now with the code GOODAREAS, or one word, to get a limited time 15% discount, and you can wear a t-shirt like this one right here.
All right. Ellie says, Eid Mubarak. What is the most important factor when it comes to power hitting? Core strength, biceps, upper body strength, swing technique, or lower body strength? I'm not an expert in this. I would assume it's core strength, but because why can little guys swing and hit the ball so far? And I've played with plenty of big cricketers who don't hit the ball all that hard. So I'd assume it has something to do with core strength. The only other thing I would say is, though, that I used to weigh about 50 kilograms more than I did, and I used to fucking hammer the ball. And then when I lost my weight, even though I think I've upped my swing speed a little bit, I just don't seem to hit as many sixes as I used. I used to hit sixes by accident. And now I have to really think and plan to hit a six. I think the force that you can put into it obviously plays a part, and your power and everything else. But if you're asking me what the most important one is, I would assume it's core strength, but I'm really guessing there. The Tooth says, have you seen much of, what's that say? Is it say Vidler? Why can't I read that? It's like all the letters have come together. Vidler. I think it says Vidler. Vidler. And what do you think of him? I haven't seen I've seen highlights of him at the moment. So I don't think I have anything strong. I think he's an interesting prospect. He's kind of like 80% limbs. What is he? 17, 18? I'm trying to find his age here. He's not very old, but he looks like, 19 years old. And what's his height? Don't think I can find his height here. He just looks like he's all limbs at the moment. So if I'm assuming you're talking about that player. But yeah, he's certainly an interesting prospect, but I want to see a little bit more. I don't know how it fully translates to the international level at the moment outside of the pace. And so when I see that's the bit that kind of, That's what I need to be able to see. So when I'm looking at a young fast bowler, I'm like, how would they get regular wickets in international cricket, right? Or top level cricket? Do they have a stock ball? Is it height? Is it bounce? Is it sideways movement? Is it skittiness? Is it whatever? And then I'm trying to put that through a machine in my head to be like, okay. So Matthew Potts is a really good example of when I first saw him, I was like, I don't know what his superpower is. And then I went back and I deconstructed him. And piece by piece, I was like, oh, so he has a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Okay, so now I understand that. And that's basically what I do. So I would need to see a little bit more of him. But at the moment, outside of the pace, which is fine and very handy, I need to see all the other little bits. Aditya says, did Ken Barrington and VBS Laxman make your long list of all-time great batters? What was your assessment of them? Both scored a lot of runs at a high average, especially Barrington, who averaged almost 60 over 82 games, but are rarely spoken about as elite among batters from their own countries. I think Barrington was certainly more than Laxman. I found Barrington one of the tougher ones to have a look at. They're both on my long list, yes. I think I'm not as high on them as maybe pure stat heads would be. Sorry, in Barrington's case. And in Laxman, the more I looked into it, the harder I found it to propel him up the list. I don't know. I might be, like, if you're a pure stat head, I'm probably too low on Barrington. And if you're a pure vibes person, I'm probably too low on Laxman. But that's kind of where I came out on both of them. I think Laxman, there's another player as well on the long list that I found very hard to deal with, and that was Hanif Mohammed, who... Both of those are fantastic players. We know they are great players, but how do you compare them to other players who have much more robust records and everything else? And in Ken Barrington's case, when I went through it line by line, I just found too many question marks in his career to put him up really, really high, which is where a lot of other people will put him because of his batting average overall. But I still think he was a fantastic batter. And I think in some ways he was underestimated. People who just look at average overestimate him, and people who had problems with him coming in and out the side and him being boring and all these other things probably underestimate him. So he's a very weird player to go back. As you say, he's not as vaunted. So I'm trying to remember, I think it was Bob White who I was talking to. Was it Bob White or was it the guy from Yorkshire? No, I think it was Bob White. No, it was both of them actually, but in two different ways. But the guy from Yorkshire, Brian Stott, I think his name is. I'd have to go back and check the book. When I was talking to him, he was basically saying that for him, Barrington did everything that Hutton did, but Hutton never made a mistake and was just a little bit better than Barrington. And so Barrington sort of comes on the back of Hutton. I don't know how you would compare them, but like, I was going to say like Michael Clarke coming on the back of Ricky Ponting, but I don't think that's quite right. I'm trying to think of another team that's maybe had something similar. Maybe I was going to say Richie Richardson and Viv Richards, but Richie Richardson never really made the runs, did he? But like, you could see how they were built very similar to each other, but you could also see why Hutton was better and people talked up Hutton more. And so in Barrington and Hutton's case, I should say, both of them are certainly players who didn't make a lot of mistakes, but somehow Hutton was still seen as the better player despite similar kind of records. In VVS Laxman's case, there is an element, I think, of how much you can index the fact that he played. Like, there are players who won't make my top 50 who I think are easily in the top 50 most talented test batters of all time, right? VVS Laxman, Aravinda De Silva, Mark Waugh, right? I would have them as much more talented than players way higher than them on my long list of 85 players or whatever it was. But it was, I didn't want to just be the most talented because then I'm just making subjective calls at a certain point. And so I still think VBS Laxman is a fantastic player and he was one of my favorites. But a lot of my favorites didn't get as high as I would have wanted them to. Lemon says, we see bowlers go for wide Yorkers. Why don't we see bowlers going for head high bounces on the wide line? Seems easy to set a field to, or is it too predictable? Lemon, the problem is, I have seen bowlers do this before, but the problem with the head with the bouncer on the wide line is you double your chances of a wide. That's why we don't see as many of them. It is hard for players to set up to hit that ball. I think the ideal ball, you almost got it, would actually be a slower ball bouncer on the wide line. But the problem is that you can't control slower balls as accurately as you can normal balls. And the problem is that you're on the wide line, so you're going to get some wides there, and you're bowling a short ball, and so you might get some wides there. So I think that's why we haven't seen it as much. But I have seen bowlers try it. Rob says, would you rather watch T20 with the impacts up or an over limit of 5 overs per bowler or even have both? I'm going to flip it a little bit, Rob. I would rather have just interchange, 15 players. You can pick from 15 players and no bowler can bowl more than, let's say, 5 overs. The impacts up for me is stupid. If you're going to have subs, let's have subs. Let's not piss about. Let's see the best batters against the best bowlers all the way through the order. I don't need this. I don't need part-timers anymore, right? Unless there's a reason to use them, not just because one of your main bowlers isn't bowling well. William says, why do England not pick their 80-mile-an-hour bowlers in and around for home test matches? I understand it would suck for away tests in Australia, but it's not like England are winning important series at home at the moment either. I think the biggest difference is that the England test wickets are not like the first-class wickets. They are a little bit flatter. And there are periods of time when those sorts of bowlers might not be as useful. There are certain series where you could go in with 4 of those, William. And I think you're right. You'd absolutely dominate. But there are other, the thing with test cricket is it's an extra 20% of the game. The pitches are made to be a little bit flatter because of that. So that sort of Darren Stevens type wicket that we all talk about in county cricket, you actually don't see many test matches ever played on that. So I don't think they'd be as effective as you think they would be. Secondly, you're then in a situation where you're creating like 2 completely different bowling attacks. And I can understand that. And maybe one day that's what we'll get to in cricket. But I don't think cricket is mentally ready for that at the moment. MF Jim says, what are some of your favorite professional cricketer rocks up to a grade match stories? I've always loved hearing that Shoaib Akhtar played Sydney grade cricket. I think I talked about this story recently when Dandenong in Melbourne, when I had 5 or 6 internationals playing for them in a club game. We used to play against Ravi Ratnaika, and I just remember him absolutely smashing the ball everywhere in that level of cricket. One of my favorite stories, though, and I don't know how many of these are out there, but there's an Australian cricketer called Julian Weiner, who was not a particularly, if you're a child and you need to laugh at the name Julian Weiner, feel free. He was a cricketer. I'm just trying to see what he played, 6 matches and 7 ODIs, basically around the World Series cricket thing. I think it would be fair to say he averaged like 30 in first class cricket. Like he wasn't a star or anything. But my memory is that he played on like forever. I want to say he was still playing cricket into the mid-2000s, maybe around 2010. That I really like that because that's just a guy who likes cricket, right? And I'm not having a go at all cricketers, but a lot of cricketers. I've got friends and, we've got charity games and stuff. And can you come up? Oh, I don't play cricket anymore, Jared. You know that. And it's like, oh, yeah, okay. Or they play in it and it's like, this is the last game I'll ever play. And I'm not having a go at them. I get it. They've been doing it for years and they're body doesn't move the same way it used to and everything. We've seen some of these veterans leagues, right? But I really like that the older cricketers who just continue to play on forever, who were Julian Weiner was kind of before it was professional, but you know what I mean? Former international players who play on forever. And I think there's a few stories of those. Those are probably my favorite. Like, it must be pretty, I never played against him in Melbourne, but it must be pretty cool to be able to bowl to a former test player if you're like a 15-year-old kid, right? I think that would be, that would be fun. Jane says, how much weight should IPL teams give to a player's age when picking them in the auction? I think players who have a good chance of giving you a terrific performance this year and maybe the next, but would be a burden on the team beyond that point. So the way I look at it, Jane, is I think the mega auction is the most important one to be looking for this. I think in the mega auction, you really want batters between the age of 24, 25 and 27, 28, because they should be reaching their peak while you have them on contract for the next 4 years. Bowlers is probably a little bit more up and down because bowlers don't have as stable a peak. Like fast bowlers might be at their best in their early 20s when they're really, really fast, right? Spinners might be at their best in their early to mid 30s when the experience and skills match their physicality. But certainly for batters, I think we know pretty much that the peak of top batters is usually between 28 and 32. That's when I want them on contract. That's why when I, we were talking about Shreyas Iyer, Ishan Kishan, there was someone else as well in the IPL. I was like, look, I, I think these are overpays in some ways, unless these guys change. And to be honest, they both had pretty good starts to this season. But I also like the fact that you have an experienced player who is now he's going to be in their peak when you've got them on contract. PJ says, if you were building cricket stadiums from scratch today, this is the second time I've been asked this today. TalkSport asked me this too. Would it not make sense to have an in-store net and bowling machine just behind the changing room dugout, similar to baseball? Yes. So I've talked to Dan Christian about this. About shouldn't you be having a net on the ground in the same lighting? So I think the Renegades might have even tried this. And I don't know if it was me. I don't know if I came up with it or if they had already tried it. At the same time, and Dan Christian, being an older cricketer who played a lot, was like, no. And I just said, I think eventually this is going to be what's happening. Because if you have a net at the moment, I think you're in a position where you're already in a slightly different lighting than you're going to get out on the ground. And I know you always get different lighting because if you're in the very middle, it's different than the lighting on the boundary and everything else. But I don't know, there is something about that. But yes, you're also right. There, you could go as far as saying, how much of a break between innings do we need? Like baseball just switches over and it's a very different kind of sport because you have multiple innings. But we do have 10 minutes of the bowlers warming up. And in many situations, couldn't they warm up off the field in this sort of situation that you're talking about, PJ? But the truth is that the reason it doesn't happen, that I talked to someone who was really keen on it and he just couldn't quite make it work. But I know they did it at the Docklands at one stage and there was one other team, Brisbane Heat, who have tried it. So teams are thinking about it. Rudra says, for a T20 power play bowler, is the ability to swing the ball in both directions enough, even if they only bowl max 130 kilometers an hour? I imagine they would be very effective in a similar way to spinners who turn the ball both ways. And shouldn't England be able to find 80 of these bowls? Okay, there aren't that many bowlers in the world who can bowl 130 kilometers an hour and swing the ball both ways. There aren't many bowlers in the world at any one time who could swing the ball both ways at the professional level. Most people around the world now bowl the wobble ball, so the ability to swing the ball one way has disappeared, let alone two ways. But yes, I think, and Rudra, I don't know if you heard the Kimapa podcast with me and Robbie the other day, he was talking about this and something I've talked about as well. People don't play the swinging ball as well as they used to, because most people don't bowl the swinging ball very much. So yes, I think you can do that. The England part is interesting because England bowlers are all wobble ball bowlers now. There aren't as many traditional swing bowlers as there used to be. So they wouldn't be able to find 80 of these anymore. Ben says, wide lines don't move depending on the physical build of the batter. Full toss, no balls, very based on the batter height and the height of the hips or even trousers. Oh, Morgan crouches really low in his stand. So is his no ball lower? No, so it's where you stand. Sorry, it's when you're standing, where your hips are, which where your waist is. It's basically the waist on your trousers is where the no ball line is when you're standing at your full height. So crouching down doesn't change that at all. And there's no reason why the wides would have nothing to do with your body type either because it's where your toes are. That the only time the wide line moves is when your toes are moving, so your physicality doesn't matter. But there's no doubt that shorter batters should get more head high full tosses than taller batters in general because of this legislation. But it's not there to legislate against poor bowling, Ben. It's there to stop batters getting hurt by head high full tosses. That's why it exists. So it's a safety thing. So it makes sense. Neil says, are you planning to watch or go and cover any of the championship or blast games this season? I don't generally, I do go and watch some championship. The last couple of years, it just hasn't worked as well as it used to. In the old days, I would go to a little bit more, but fatherhood and being around and stuff, like if I go to a game, unless, you know, my wife is in charge of the children that day or someone else is in charge of the children, it's a day where I kind of probably have to do something else. And so if I go to a day with the cricket, it's usually I've got childcare set up or I've got, you know, whatever that may be. Looked after. So I haven't gone to as much. I got a ground around the corner from me, the Beckenham ground, and I go there when there are games, but I go and watch everything there. They don't play a lot of championship there. Play a little bit of women's cricket, a little bit of A cricket, a little bit of under 19. So I like to go down and watch and see all those players, take notes on them. So when someone asked me about Callum Vidler, I have extra notes. What else? Blast games, no. I think this is a year I'll probably take the boys to a couple of hundred games kind of do that. It just hasn't worked over the last couple of years. And I suppose with my business being much more based in my office and now my studio, right? It makes more sense for me to be here and do stuff than it does for me to be at the ground. This year I'll be at 7 tests. I don't know if I'm doing that much outside of the test matches, but yeah, I'll be at grounds a little bit more. But yeah, I don't get that much out of the championship and the Blast games. I can watch if I'm at home and a Blast game is on and the game isn't very good, or I'm not interested, or something's happening in another game, or there's a player I want to follow, I can just switch over. It's a little bit harder to do, although you can do it at the ground, but it's a bit weird to be at the ground watching a Blast game and have another game on. Although I've probably done that before as well. But yeah, I don't cover English domestic cricket, right? I don't even cover the 100. So it doesn't make that much sense for me to be at the grounds, but sometimes I can go. I've got a press accreditation, so I will get press accreditation, but I don't even think I got my press accreditation last year because it was the IPL and then it was the World Cup. And I took like a month off after that. My family was over and stuff. So I think last year might've been the only year I didn't even have a press accreditation, or maybe I did. Can't remember now. I just didn't go to many games. All right, let's have a quick break. And then when we come back from this, there will be more of the Wagon Wheel.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts, and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
All right, welcome back. Sing Silly's Point with a super chat says, whole career, all formats weighted equally. Who had a better career, Bhuvie or Shami? Shami. I mean, he's a very, very good test match bowler. One of the great ODI bowlers and has been okay in T20 cricket with some very good moments. Bhuvie was a decent test match bowler. I can't even remember his ODI figures, but certainly doesn't compare to Shami, and the better T20 bowler, but it's not even close for their whole careers. And I say this is Team Bhuvie. Team Bhuvie all the way, but it's Shami. Rudra says, do you think they'll ever get to the point where a player's lack of trophies in the IPL will quite negatively affect their legacy like the NBA? Please see AB de Villiers and Chris Gayle. It's already started. I don't think we're quite into rings culture like the NBA. The NBA is such a weird sport, though, because while I understand the nonsense behind it, like Charles Barkley was one of the best offensive players I've ever seen. Trying to think of Kevin Garnett. Only won one ring and is probably a top 10 player of all time. Like, might be in the top 5 best defensive players and in the top 15 best offensive players, and wasn't even used that well, right? So yeah, I think there's certainly, but in basketball, you've only got one guy, you've only got 5 players on the court, right? Cricket's a little bit different when you stretch it out, but we're already starting to see the Indian players. Virat Kohli was already starting to deal with rings culture, right? Because they weren't winning many trophies under him, with him in India, you know, with the Indian team. And then he wasn't winning any with RCB. I've heard the same set of Gayle. I've heard the same set of AB de Villiers. So yeah, I think it's already there, but I don't think it'll ever get to the level of NBA just because there are 11 players on the field, or 12 now on the field. Well, 11 on the field, 12 in the side. And so your impact is negated. Whereas in basketball, you know, you can have a basketballer who might have 40% or 45% usage, right? No, on offense. And then if they might have 25 to 30% on defense, there's no cricketer who can ever get close to those numbers. So it's a very different kind of sport. So I think basketball is a little bit more unique in that way. But there will always be an aspect of that. Quick Process says, should CSK continue to open with Tripathi? Is this their best opening combo, or are they a power play bowler short? Is Ashwin messing with the balance? I don't think Ashwin's messing with the balance at all. It's just he's not been very good. If he's playing good, I don't think he's messing with the balance. Robbie doesn't like Tripathi at the top. I do like Tripathi at the top if Gaikwad's going to keep playing the way he is at the moment. They can mix and match a lot. They just look like a team that doesn't have many players in form. Like, there are probably many different threads you can pull out with CSK at the moment. But if I was working with them, I'd be like, I think we should just find form. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but sometimes that is kind of exactly what the issue is. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the actual team as it is constructed should be winning more games than it currently is. So how do you kind of get your head around that kind of situation? Like, I don't know how you really handle that sort of stuff. You should always be informed when you can. ABCD, you've sent a super chat thingy, but no super chat. I couldn't find it anyway. And Varun couldn't find it, obviously. Saurabh says, what's up with all the players like Hardik Pandya and Pant? What's up with players like, do you think there is more Do you think it is more difficult for the all-rounders to make the switch from ODIs to T20s quickly? Is there a pattern? I think the pattern is that there is still an undercurrent, especially within leadership roles of Indian cricket, where you have to play the sensible innings and be the anchor and all these sorts of things. That's what I think is the key. But yeah, it's ridiculous that those two players are playing in the way they do. There is no reason for them to play that way. Show maturity, whatever it is. It's nonsense. Hardik Pandya can average 27 with a strike rate of 160. Let's do that. That's a fantastic player. There aren't many of them around, and he can bowl. Manan says, Kim Happer show appreciation super chat. Yeah, we will be doing live ones as well. I don't know if we'll be able to take too many super chats. Oh my God, we went for an hour and 10 minutes the other day, and I barely had any notes. Huge thanks to everyone. If you haven't gone and seen it or listened to it or whatever that may be, please do. It's something that we're both really excited about, and we want to do at least, you know, once a week going ahead. And who knows where we could grow it. But, you know, we don't know each other particularly well. We've only had a couple of chats, but it's quite clear that we work really well together. So when you have a partnership like that, and I've been lucky enough to have a bunch of them in my career, you know, Sam Collins, you know, George Dobell, Andy Zaltzman, all these different people that I've had this partnership with, I think Robbie could be another one. So thank you very much. Please tell your mum about the show, all that sort of stuff, and we will continue to do as many as we can. Ian says, have you watched an Indian movie, Animal? No, I don't really. If it's a Bollywood movie, I don't really watch Bollywood movies. I don't really watch that many non-Bollywood movies. I got three kids watching movies. In fact, I'm really lucky that recently Ezekiel's got obsessed with movies. And so I bought him a book ages ago for like a pound at a charity shop, like an old book that 501 movies you must watch before you die. Some weird movies in that, by the way. Young Guns. I don't think Young Guns is a movie you must watch before you die. But he's been going through them. So we watched The Third Man the other day. He watched Godfather on his own. And so we're going through them. But yeah, so that's where I'm watching at the moment. Whatever some random writer suggested was one of the best movies it's probably 90% Hollywood movies, I would assume, and there a couple of overseas ones, but there aren't many. So that's all my movies at the moment. I was a big film buff myself and have watched films from all around the world. Bollywood films have just never really done it for me. Big fan of Japanese films, going back a long period of time, and French films was always another one, Italian films. But I've never massively got into Indian films. We had to watch them. In fact, I think I worked on a Bollywood film. Did I work on that film? Or was I there? I know my friend certainly worked on the film. There was a Bollywood film set in Melbourne, and I was there. Don't think I worked on it. Or maybe I helped out briefly. So I probably worked on more films that I've actually been involved with, or at least seen more films film. Bluey says, should CSK go with the top three of Conway, Ratchan, and Rutu to set up the entry points for Shankar, Dubé, Jadeja, and MS? You'd have Khalil and Cambodge in power play and three spinners and Pathrana with the ball. I don't know. What Conway are you getting, Bluey? That would be one of the questions I have. He doesn't look like the Conway of a couple of years ago. And so if you could tell me he was going to be that Conway, I'd be more comfortable. I'm a Tripathi man, though. I'm staying loyal. Walking Alive says, do stats show if red soil behaves different to black soil under dew? From matches I've watched, red soil still grips and remains to get tougher for batting, while black soil definitely helps the batting side. I don't know. The whole red soil, black soil, I don't think red soil, black soil, also. The problem with this is a bit like saying Asian pitches. Oh, Asian pitches do this. Well, there are multiple different kinds of Asian pitches. Pakistan pitches are not like Indian pitches. Indian pitches in different parts are not like each other. Sri Lanka pitches are not particularly like Indian pitches. Bangladesh pitches are different again, right? UAE pitches are slightly different. So to think that all red soil wickets would act the same under dew and all black soil pitches would be the same under dew, I don't know. I would say that red soil pitches have more grip, and so even with dew, they're more likely to still grip would be my guess. But that's just off the top of my head. Yash with the super chat says, how much truth is in my father saying batters and bowlers were much better than now, and how Virat Kohli would probably average 8 if he played in another era, and what with the sketchy fake Kabaddi World Cup? I haven't seen the sketchy fake Kabaddi World Cup. Virat Kohli would average 8 in another era. I mean, that's obviously wrong, isn't it? There's no era that Virat Kohli would average eight unless he played in the 1700s and they're rolling the ball on the ground and he doesn't understand what the sport is. Yeah, the batters and bowlers weren't that much better. That, it's just nostalgia talk, right? We have in Trent Bolt one of the most skillful left armers we've ever had. We've only had like one skillful level before. We never used to have, you know, when Joel Garner played, we all went on and on about how tall Joel Garner was. Joel Garner's a pretty normal height for a fast bowler now, and there are many guys way taller than Joel Garner. When the four West Indians bowled at, you know, 90 miles an hour, everyone crapped themselves. Regular teams, England have gone in with teams with four 90 mile an hour bowlers and above, right? Since then, they're not even a fast bowling culture. Spinners bowl quicker and spin the ball more. Batters have more options. They're fitter. They're, you know, training in better ways. Yeah, cricket just continues to get better and better. There are probably periods that Virat Kohli would have struggled because it didn't suit his game. I wonder how he would have gone in the sort of outswing era of the, what, 60s and 70s, maybe a little bit, even into the 80s outside of the West Indies, just because of the way he bats. I think his batting is more set up for that sort of 90s, 2000 style of hit the wicket style bowling. So I think there are eras he would have done better in and worse in. He obviously would not have averaged eight. If anyone is saying that to you with a straight face, I think you have to just shrug your shoulders and move on. ABCD says, if you were controlling Gujarat Titans, would you look to make a trade involving Sai or make an even bigger trade with Gill? You have to consider commercial needs also, or would you do nothing? It just depends on what you get back, right? Yes, I would probably trade one of them. And I would probably trade Sai. Because I'm pretty sure that Shubman Gill is going to be a star over the next couple of years. And I think Sai's a fantastic player, but I can't guarantee he's going to be a star. It's similar. It's weirdly to go back to an NBA trade that I remember from a few years ago, which was they had two players at Sacramento Kings. What a terribly run franchise that is. They had two players there and they decided they wanted to trade one away for Sabonis. Don't know why, but they drafted two guys that were too similar to each other, a little bit like Gill and Sai Sadarshan. And so they had to make the trade. And they chose the slightly more experienced one that they knew the future of, whereas I probably would have gone with the younger one and that one that had the higher ceiling. In this situation, I'm not sure Sai has the young at the higher ceiling. So if it was Jaiswal, I'm not saying that he's similar to Gill, but let's pretend it's the same. I think if it was Jaiswal, I'd be like, I would get rid of the more senior player based on the fact that I think the other guy has a higher ceiling. And so I'm swinging for that. Whereas I think in this case, I'm not sure that Sai is ever going to be massively better than Shubman Gill. And I already know how good Shubman Gill is, right? And I know he's going to be a star for India over the next few years. He's averaging like a billion in ODI cricket. Will eventually work Test cricket out, would be my guess. Whereas I don't even know if Sai is going to make it to Test cricket at this point and whether he will work it out. Although I've got some hopes. But then it depends on what you get back. So let's just put this in the IPL trade machine, which doesn't exist, and we need IPL trade machines. But if you're trading Gill, what do you want back? You want something like Rishabh Pant. I'm trying to think of someone else on the way out. I don't, you know, maybe Shreyas Iyer, Ishan Kishan, Hardik Pandya, right? I'm not sure Gill would quite get you a Hardik Pandya, but maybe Gill plus something else that you have on your roster might get you a Hardik Pandya. And what does Sai Sadarshan get you? Sai Sadarshan probably gets you more, not the Venky, but I like a Venky type player, Muhammad Siraj potentially, an Ashdeep Singh type player. So that just that slight level down. And so you'd be looking at someone. So what you try and do in that situation is you try and get two players who end up having the same age range as each other so that that becomes the corner block of your team. So Shubman Gill is 25 years old. So you want someone around 25, 26. Who is going to play in a vastly different way than him. And that's kind of the way that you would put this together if it was me. I would say that's how I'd be looking at it. But yeah, I wouldn't be trading Sai unless I knew I was getting something pretty good back. Shrikant says, am I guessing your top 10 right? Bradman, Sachin, Hobbs, Sobers, Steve Smith, Lara, Richards, Gavaskar, Grace, Hammond. No, you are not. Good try. But of course, with the book coming out on the 8th of May, I might just be saying that, Shrikant, to throw you off. We don't know, but you're also wrong. Bluey says, what elements of Fleming making him a conservative T20 coach? Is he behind the eight ball now? What's made him so successful? He was brilliant at understanding that home pitch conditions were more important than anything else, and then completely backing that with the system. So home pitch conditions are really, really important. So what are we going to do now? We're going to make sure that everyone can play spin and everyone can bowl spin. And then to come through Chennai, chances are you're going to lose multiple of our games, and then we still have a good enough all-round team to be able to win at least 50% away from home. That gets us into the playoffs, and then we see how we go. He's always believed in slow starters rather than fast starters. That's starting to become... I always thought that was an issue. I know that Flem doesn't think it's an issue. He might be changing now because he believes in the catch-up innings. We're seeing now catch-up innings don't exist as much anymore. He perfected a method, right, that really worked really well for them. And so he probably didn't pioneer everything else, but they did some great things. Like, I was just talking about this today on TalkSport as well. They did some excellent things, like the not going for the big name overseas players. You should be spending the majority of your money on homegrown players, unless there's something specifically that you need that you can only get through one overseas player, right? So the Fizz, I don't know, a Marcus Stoinis type player that doesn't exist in India, right? Rashid Khan, whatever that may be. In every other way, you should be spending your money on Indian players and then getting role-playing international players that fit in with the style that you want to play. And I think they understood all of that sort of stuff, and they were ahead of it. But I do believe he believes in that sort of 160 to 180 type games. He will make conservative decisions, I think, sometimes, rather than the more rock your boat kinds of decisions. And it's become a bit of a rock your boat type of game, hasn't it? Things have changed. All right, talking about things have changed, I've gone into the start of the IPL game. I didn't mean to do that, but here we are. Thank you very much to everyone on Wagon Wheel. Remember, chuck us a like or do whatever you need to do on the way out, and we will see you again. Don't know why someone's clapping there. Chuck us a like because it helps with the algorithm. Go watch the Roman Utapa one, and we've put the power ratings up as well. See you then. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.